Welcome to Dermatologic Oncology Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Paul Chapman to discuss new research in melanoma, and to begin, he summarized the number of new data sets presented in June at the American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting.
A couple of things important were presented at ASCO regarding the treatment of metastatic melanoma. One was the BRAF inhibitor story continued. There's now a second BRAF inhibitor called the dabrafenib that has shown very similar activity compared to vemurafenib. It has the same response rate, same improvement in progression-free survival, although overall survival was not formally tested in the trial. But many of us think that the dabrafenib will get FDA approved and will be another option for physicians to treat metastatic melanoma that has a BRAF mutation.
Maybe we can explore that a little bit because that was a fascinating presentation. Can you talk a little bit more about the efficacy, how it seems to compare to vemurafenib, and particularly the toxicity?
The efficacy was measured a couple of ways. One, obviously, is simply the response rate, and that was very similar to vemurafenib. It was about 50% of the patients developed a formal RECIST criteria partial response or complete response. So that's very similar to vemurafenib, which is about 57%. The other thing was that the progression-free survival as compared to dacarbazine was also significantly improved. It's hard to really compare trials, but the median progression-free survival was about 5 months compared to 7 months for vemurafenib. I'm not sure that that difference is really significant. Now, vemurafenib also measured overall survival, but that was not a primary endpoint of this trial. It was not powered to measure overall survival, so we won't get, I don't think we'll get overall survival data, but the parameters that were measured look very, very similar to vemurafenib in terms of efficacy. In terms of toxicity, there is a sense that maybe the new drug, dabrafenib, might have fewer side effects, but that's still going to require additional work. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but initially it looks like there may be some fewer side effects with dabrafenib.
What about the actual quality of the side effects? I had the impression that it was a little bit different than vemurafenib.
Qualitatively, they were very, very similar. It was quantitative. The sense was that maybe there were fewer keratoacanthomas and squamous cell cancers of the skin seen with the dabrafenib, the newer drug. It was a small difference. I don't know how confident we can be.
I think the thing that actually had been mentioned was the issue about like pyrexia and headache.
Yeah. Now, so the new drug did have some fever associated with it, which vemurafenib has not had. Again, I think that side effect was really quite minimal, and it was very uncommon.
Do we know anything at this point in terms of cross-sensitivity between vemurafenib and dabrafenib? Have there been patients treated with vemurafenib after dabrafenib and vice versa?
Very few, and nothing in a formal setting, of course. I myself have treated one or two patients with vemurafenib after they'd progressed on dabrafenib. I didn't see any remarkable responses, and one would anticipate that the resistance mechanisms would be similar between the two drugs, but this hasn't been tested formally.
You were part of a paper at ASCO looking at the issue of rash in patients who got vemurafenib after ipilimumab. Can you talk about what you reported there?
Our observation was that in about a dozen patients who had had ipilimumab and then went on to get vemurafenib, we saw really immediate and extensive rashes on these patients. And we speculated that the immune activation induced by ipilimumab might make patients more sensitive to drug rashes in general, and these patients had gotten vemurafenib, which can cause a rash just in and of itself. So we've been cautioning physicians that in patients who have been on ipilimumab within the month, they may have a higher risk of developing a significant rash to vemurafenib. These rashes were self-limited once you stop the vemurafenib, and if you wait long enough, you can restart the vemurafenib without too much problem.
What do we know right now in terms of, I think there are trials out there combining ipilimumab and vemurafenib. Do you see this rash more?
So there is a trial, a phase one trial combining them. We are doing this trial at Memorial in collaboration with co-investigators at UCLA and at Yale. This is run by my colleague, Jed Walchuk. And so far, combining them together, we've seen some rash, but that hasn't been a major issue. And we are currently in the midst of dose escalation. I would like to stress that we do not know if this combination is ultimately safe. And I would strongly recommend that physicians not combine these two drugs at this point until we know that not only is it safe, but it may actually not be a good thing to do in terms of efficacy. We don't know that yet.
So in that you brought up this new BRAF inhibitor, I think it's also relevant to talk about the old one, which isn't too old, vemurafenib, and you presented at ASCO an update of the BRIM3 study. Anything new and exciting there?
Well, I think the story there was that the response rate actually had gone up from 48% to 57%, and that's simply a matter of having had more follow-up time. The progression-free survival remained the same with a marked advantage to vemurafenib. The overall survival, now with 12 months median follow-up compared to 3 months, still showed a significant improvement in overall survival. This was an interesting time point because at this point, many of the dacarbazine patients had crossed over to vemurafenib. And even taking that into consideration, the overall survival benefit was still apparent for vemurafenib.
Now, there was a presentation, again, looking at this other BRAF inhibitor, dabrafenib, focusing on patients with brain mets. What did they see, and what's been seen with vemurafenib with brain mets?
So this is pretty important. In the vemurafenib trials, patients with brain metastases were excluded, and that was because there was no information one way or the other whether this drug could cross the blood-brain barrier, and in fact, it's molecular structure predicted that it would not. In the dabrafenib trials, they were a little bit more open-minded and included some brain metastases patients and found that there were some responses. And so, as you mentioned, we participated in this multicenter phase 2 trial with dabrafenib in patients with metastatic melanoma who had the BRAF mutation and who had brain metastases. And what this showed was that patients with brain metastases were just as likely to respond as patients without brain metastases, and this drug clearly can cause responses in the brain just like it can cause responses in metastases anywhere else. Since this time, vemurafenib has been used in patients with brain metastases, and at least my experience has been very similar to dabrafenib. Both of these drugs, I think, have activity in the brain. So I think there are certain important lessons here. One lesson is, and many of us have been saying this for a while, the preclinical animal models of brain metastasis are really not valid. If a drug crosses the blood-brain barrier in a healthy rat, it really does not predict whether it crosses the blood-brain barrier in a patient with a brain metastasis. Second, this shows us that if your tumor has the BRAF mutation, it's addicted to the BRAF mutated kinase, and an inhibitor will inhibit the tumor no matter where that tumor is. And the third point, of course, is that now we have a drug that is active in the brain. And I think many of us believe that in a patient who has multiple brain metastases and in whom you would normally give whole brain radiation therapy, if that patient has a BRAF mutation, treating them with a BRAF inhibitor is better than treating them with whole brain radiation.
I've seen that with your colleagues down the hall in non-small cell with the EGFR inhibitors, you know, the same kind of philosophy and the same kind of responses in the brain. What do we know right now in terms of mechanisms of resistance when patients do progress on these agents?
Well, we know a lot more than we knew 3 years ago. One thing that we know is that if you look at the resistant tumors, they have reactivated the MAP kinase pathway. The question is, how have they done that? In about half of the tumors, we understand how they've done it. One way they can do it is by developing a mutation upstream of BRAF in the NRAS gene. So some tumors will have an NRAS mutation. Another way they can do it is by amplifying the BRAF gene itself so that there's so much mutated BRAF that it sort of floods out the drug. And then a third way is with a what we've shown is a splice variant of the mutated BRAF. The tumor splices out a piece of the protein so that now this shortened protein, which is still active, now dimerizes with the other RAF molecules in the cell, and through a mechanism which is probably a little too complicated to explain just in audio, it makes it resistant to the drug. Those are the mechanisms that have been seen by more than one investigator at more than one institution. There are certainly other mechanisms of resistance, mostly upstream of RAS, and it's very important that we biopsy these resistant tumors so that we can study these resistant mechanisms.
So trying to take another step forward in the water of mutations and biologic therapy, I see that the METRIC study of trametinib was just published. And then at ASCO, Dr. Weber presented the study looking at this agent combined with dabrafenib, the agent we just talked about. How about if we move forward and talk about trametinib?
Sure. So downstream of RAF in the MAP kinase pathway is MEK. And there's been great interest to develop inhibitors of MEK. The first generation MEK inhibitors have not been too successful, partly because they had a lot of side effects. The study presented by Caroline Robert, this METRIC study, was a phase 3 trial using the MEK inhibitor that seems most hopeful in terms of its activity and its toxicity. And in that trial, patients with a BRAF mutated melanoma were again randomized to either the MEK inhibitor, trametinib, or standard chemotherapy, either dacarbazine or paclitaxel. And that trial showed that the progression-free survival was clearly better with the MEK inhibitor, and the response rate was also much higher. I think they had a 22% response rate compared to about 8% with chemotherapy. So it is very likely that this MEK inhibitor would get FDA approval as well.
And what about the combination with the BRAF inhibitor?
So the combination trial is a trial combining this MEK inhibitor with the BRAF inhibitor, dabrafenib. The rationale for doing that is that when you treat patients with a BRAF inhibitor alone, although you can see about 80% of the patients develop some kind of tumor shrinkage, very few of them actually get a complete response. So one of the ideas was if we added a MEK inhibitor, perhaps we could get a higher rate of complete responses and maybe actually cure some patients. The other rationale was that tumors get resistant to these BRAF inhibitors at a median time of about 7 months. And it was thought that the addition of a MEK inhibitor could delay this significantly. So that was really important. And a third rationale was that the addition of a MEK inhibitor should decrease some of the toxicity seen with a BRAF inhibitor, such as the skin proliferative changes, such as keratoacanthomas and squamous cell cancers of the skin. So the trial that was presented by Jeff Weber was part of a complicated phase 1, phase 2 trial, but what Jeff presented was one part of it in which patients with a BRAF mutation were treated with a combination of dabrafenib and trametinib. They looked at a couple of different combinations of doses, but what they found was that the combination, which whatever dose they used, the combination had a significant response rate. And also, they're still following patients, so we don't know exactly what the final progression-free survival was, but the one they reported was about 7.5 months. The important part of their trial academically is that they've identified the precise doses of each drug that they want to take forward into a formal phase 3 trial. But what the field is still trying to digest is whether this combination is going to prove superior to just the BRAF inhibitor alone.
Can you talk more about sort of the interaction of symptoms? I had the impression that as you said, that somehow the two were offsetting each other in some way?
That's the hope. I think from the data presented at ASCO, I think that question is still open. What we've known now for a couple of years is that the melanomas that have this BRAF mutation, they are addicted to the BRAF mutation, and if you give them an inhibitor, they will die. But in cells that are wild type for BRAF, have normal BRAF, we've known that these drugs can actually cause proliferation of these cells, and that's probably the basis for why we get these skin toxicities. The preclinical data from the laboratory predicted that the addition of a MEK inhibitor would prevent this proliferation. And so we were hoping that the addition of a MEK inhibitor would decrease the incidence of squamous cell cancers. The question really is whether that's true, and I think the data presented at ASCO are not sufficient to really answer that question. The incidence of squamous cell cancers at the combination seem to be lower than with the BRAF inhibitor alone, but whether that's significant, I mean, the numbers of patients treated were just too small, so that I think we'll have to wait till the randomized trial is actually done to see if that holds true.
Is there any reason to think that a MEK inhibitor like trametinib would be effective in BRAF negative tumors?
There are some data from the laboratory that in some melanomas that have a NRAS mutation, which is upstream of BRAF, some of those are sensitive to MEK inhibition. And the challenge is going to be to identify that subset of tumors from the other tumors that are not going to be sensitive.
What do we know about sort of sequential use of a MEK inhibitor like trametinib and a BRAF inhibitor? Have there been any patients treated with both sequentially in either sequence? What's been seen? What would you speculate?
Well, I can tell you what has been seen in the trametinib, the MEK inhibitor trial. There was a cohort of patients treated who had previously had a BRAF inhibitor and then had progressed. In those patients, there were very few responses. So it looks like the BRAF-resistant tumors are not going to be MEK-sensitive. That's about the only data that I know of. The speculation is that the value of a MEK inhibitor is going to be in combination rather than by itself.
Do you see this agent, trametinib, becoming available, and if so, when?
That's a good question. I don't know this for sure, but I would suspect that the company has already started filing with the FDA to get this approved. The real question is going to be, if it does get approved, will there be a role for it as a single agent? Right now, among the BRAF mutated tumors, I think it's hard to see a population where you would use this MEK inhibitor instead of a BRAF inhibitor. The response rates to MEK inhibitors are lower. The duration of responses are shorter. So I actually don't see it being used as a single agent myself.
Do you think there's enough data to use it in combination?
Not yet, but there is a randomized trial currently ongoing in patients with BRAF mutations, randomized to receive either the BRAF inhibitor alone or the BRAF inhibitor plus trametinib. And I think that's going to be the pivotal trial.
What's the status of ongoing and being discussed adjuvant trials using these agents?
Well, both BRAF inhibitors, vemurafenib and dabrafenib, are about to start in the adjuvant setting. Vemurafenib probably will start soonest in the adjuvant setting, and that's going to be a trial in patients who have stage 3 melanoma but are free of disease. These are patients who have metastatic disease to the lymph nodes but do not have hematogenous metastases. And these patients will have been completely excised and so are free of disease but at high risk for recurrence. In the trial, patients will be randomized to receive either vemurafenib or a placebo. And the point of the trial will be to see if there's any evidence of improved overall survival.
How does interferon get integrated, if at all, in the trial?
In these trials, interferon is not part of the trial. And as you know, interferon has never been shown to improve overall survival in the three large randomized trials published to date. And so I think, in our experience, fewer and fewer practitioners are using interferon.
What about the duration of treatment in these adjuvant trials?
Well, that's an important question, and we pondered over this a lot and decided that no one could come up with a rational duration for these trials. And so 1 year of treatment was selected kind of arbitrarily.
Any speculations about how people are going to tolerate a year of this?
Yes, I have speculations. Some people will tolerate it fine, but most of them will not. Most of them will require, in my estimation, a dose reduction. I think there'll be very few patients who will have to come off drug for toxicity, but there may be some. It sort of depends on whether or not the trial will allow us to diverge from a daily treatment. In my experience with vemurafenib, I've found that it's not uncommon that patients have to have drug holidays. So I have several patients who will have 2 weeks on and then 1 week off of drug because of fatigue or because of joint pain. And we'll see if the trial permits that.
Is there a correlation between dose of BRAF inhibitor and symptoms, and any evidence that you could use a lower dose?
Yes, I think there's a lot of evidence that decreasing the dose can decrease the problems with fatigue and can decrease some of the joint pain and skin rash sometimes. So it's common for us to go from 960 milligrams twice daily to 720 milligrams twice daily. And by the way, I would tell people that 720 milligrams we think is just as active a dose as is 960.
Let's talk a little bit about anti-PD-1, where we've seen some pretty interesting data in renal cell cancer, lung cancer, and melanoma.
So the anti-PD-1 could be thought of as the cousin of ipilimumab. Both of these monoclonal antibodies bind to T cells and block negative signals that T cells are receiving from the tumor. So as you know, ipilimumab was approved by the FDA last year, last March. And there it was approved because it improved overall survival. We've been working with colleagues around the country with a new drug called anti-PD-1, which I think it's safe to say that we're all even more excited about anti-PD-1 than we were about ipilimumab. The response rates seem to be higher, which were confirmed by a report at ASCO by Dr. Suzanne Topalian, where the response rates were almost twice that seen with ipilimumab. The other nice thing about anti-PD-1 is that the side effects seem to be fewer and less severe in general. And it's also possible that we're going to be able to figure out beforehand which tumors are going to be sensitive to treatment with anti-PD-1. This is different from ipilimumab, where we really do not have a clue at this point how to predict which patients are going to respond. The other point to make, as you had started with this section, that anti-PD-1 seems to be very active in certain other cancers, most notably non-small cell lung cancer.
Have you had patients treated with the drug?
Yes.
And what have you observed in terms of side effects? It still seems like it's kind of an autoimmune thing, just not as much as ipi.
I think that's right. It is certainly autoimmune, and people can get colitis the way they can with ipilimumab, but it certainly seems to be less frequent. The other problem with ipilimumab is you can get autoimmunity in other organs, most notably in the pituitary gland, and a small proportion of patients can become panhypopit. And we're very sensitive to that and are looking for this in all the patients we treat with ipi. With anti-PD-1, it's not been as big an issue. The one issue with anti-PD-1 is there have been a couple of patients who've developed autoimmune pneumonitis, which we don't see with ipi. And so we're on the lookout for that in all patients, and we treat it very aggressively. The one patient that I had, who was a young woman, hardly symptomatic at all, but a routine chest x-ray that we were following looked pretty bad. And she didn't understand why I admitted her to the hospital for a week of high-dose steroids, because she felt fine and was working from her bed, trying to keep up at work. But I was pretty concerned. And I think we've learned from other patients that if you don't jump on these cases right away with high-dose steroids, you can get into big troubles. Luckily, she did great, and she actually went on. We actually stopped drug at that point, but she'd already had a complete response.
Kind of scary to think it could be that extensive radiologically and not symptomatic. What do you do in terms of screening for it?
Well, as standard for this drug, we would normally follow O2 saturations pretty carefully. We also, although we're not routinely doing chest x-rays, we are just asking patients about very subtle lung symptoms, such as a new cough or just any shortness of breath at all, we worked that up pretty quickly.
Do we know anything, and we should mention, of course, the New England Journal publication looking at this also by Dr. Topalian.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know anything, again, about sort of cross-resistance between anti-PD-1 and IPI? Have there been patients treated with both sequentially?
There have not been patients treated sequentially, but there are patients being treated sequentially. We are currently involved in a phase 1 trial combining IPI plus anti-PD-1. As part of that trial, there's a cohort of patients who have received and completed their ipilimumab treatment who are now eligible to get a round of anti-PD-1. So these patients are now being treated just now, and it's really sort of a safety question, but the real issue is going to be whether combining these drugs together is a good thing.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. And when you think about it, I can't even begin to imagine the overall immunologic impact of combining the two drugs. Maybe you can explain it.
Well, if you think about it, it could be scary, right? You've got two different drugs that are each removing a different brake on the T cells. Having said that, we are doing this phase 1 trial with collaborators at Yale University, and we are slowly increasing the doses of each drug in combination. And I can say that we haven't had anything terrible happen in terms of side effects. And on the other hand, we've had some really remarkable good things happen to these patients. So we're very excited about this combination, but we need to finish this phase 1 trial to find out, you know, which doses we really need to use with each of these drugs.
Sounds like things could get pretty complicated / dizzying for the doctor in practice pretty soon.
Well, maybe I could simplify it, because it may actually turn out to be much simpler. I think the doctors in private practice should keep their eyes on these immunotherapies. I think my gut feeling, and it's just my personal opinion, but I'm anticipating that the anti-PD-1 drug will ultimately replace IPI as our first-line immunotherapy for these patients. That is, unless the combination eclipses either one of them alone, which is possible. But in that case, that may turn out to be the doc's first line of therapy. But the other point that I think has to be made, that in 2012, part of the evaluation of metastatic melanoma is genotyping the tumor. Right now, we have to know whether the tumor has a BRAF mutation. And I'm hoping that in the future, we will also have to know about some of the other mutations in these tumors. And so I'm trying to stress to colleagues that if the pathologist returns the report as saying, confirming metastatic melanoma, that that is not sufficient. We need to know that, but we need to know what the genotype is. And then I think it'll ultimately be easier for the practicing physician, because we won't have to remember these various different chemotherapy combinations, none of which were particularly effective. And now we'll have several effective treatments for these patients, partially based on what we learn about their tumor, whether they have a BRAF mutation, whether they have other mutations. In the case of anti-PD-1, whether the tumor expresses something called PD-L1, that may be the marker for sensitivity to this drug.
As what we've seen over the last few years with the ipilimumab studies and now anti-PD-1, in any way affected your thoughts about high-dose interleukin in terms of how it works, when it should be used, if at all?
Well, that's another question that the field is struggling with. I view interleukin-2 as being an option, but in only a subset of patients. As you know, it's a difficult treatment. It needs to be done at a center that has significant resources and experience with this drug. And even in the best centers, the overall response rate is less than 20%, although there are some long-term cures. Whether the cure rate is 2% or 5%, people argue. But there are patients who are clearly cured by IL-2. The point, though, is that with these other drugs, we get similar numbers with less toxicity. So I think IL-2 is an option for patients who haven't responded to any of these immunotherapies that we've talked about, or haven't responded to the targeted therapy, or perhaps don't have an actionable mutation, they don't have a BRAF mutation. But if they're in good shape, I think IL-2 should be considered.
How do you conceptualize the actual mechanism by which IL-2 works?
I've thought about this for a long time, and I think the easy answer is that it activates T cells, but it's such a crude way of activating T cells, and the fact that it activates regulatory T cells as well makes it hard to understand exactly how it works, and that may be part of the explanation as to why the response rate's so low. Along those lines, there's exciting work that has been done now for several years at the National Cancer Institute, in which patients' tumors are harvested and the T cells from those tumors are grown and then infused back into patients with IL-2. And in those settings, response rates is up to 50 to 70% have been reported. So I think there's a lot that we're learning on how to do this, and hopefully this could be translated into techniques that can be used outside of the National Cancer Institute.
What's going on right now in terms of adjuvant trials of immunotherapy, ipilimumab, anti-PD-1, et cetera?
There has already been a large adjuvant therapy with ipilimumab in patients who have stage 3 melanoma but are free of disease. Those patients were treated with ipilimumab or a placebo. Those results are not available yet because follow-up is not sufficient, but we're hoping that within a year or so, we will know the results. So there, the question will be, did adjuvant ipilimumab improve survival? I think that's the important thing. Did it improve overall survival? And ultimately, remember, patients with melanoma will probably get ipilimumab one way or the other. So is it better to give everybody adjuvant ipilimumab, or is it equally effective to simply treat those who recur with ipilimumab at the time of recurrence? That's going to be the question, and we'll have to assess not only the efficacy of that trial, but also what kind of toxicities did we see? Is it worth all the toxicities in everybody, or is it better to simply wait until we know whom to treat and then treat those patients? In terms of anti-PD-1, there has not yet been an adjuvant trial with anti-PD-1, so we don't have any information there.
Do we know anything right now in terms of toxicity with IPI in the adjuvant trial?
Well, we don't know that formally because that trial is still blinded. So officially, we don't know anything.
But I guess you might infer if there was something major going on, they would know about it and stop the trial, but...
Yeah, so that we do know, and we've asked the sponsor about that, and certainly they have a independent data safety monitoring committee looking at the data. So the trial has not been stopped.
Have you put patients on this study?
Yes.
Any reason to think, either theoretically or even practically, based on what you've seen, that toxicity would be easier or more difficult in the adjuvant setting?
Well, I think going into the study, no one had any preconceived notions. I think having done it now, our suspicion is that it may be more toxic in the adjuvant setting. Again, we don't know that for sure because it's still blinded, but among the patients we've treated, we thought we saw more severe ipi-related toxicity among patients we assumed were on ipilimumab. And no one really knows why that might be. Some people have speculated that in the absence of tumor, in the absence of significant number of anti-T cells, that there are more normal type cells available to be activated by the ipilimumab, and that's maybe why we might see more severe autoimmunity.
Any correlation between age and side effects / autoimmunity?
The data I've seen don't show much of a correlation, although my personal experience seems to be that older folks do pretty well on this drug.
When you start out ipilimumab right now on a patient, whether on a protocol or not, in your own mind, or even if the patient, you know, asks you, what do you expect in terms of, first of all, the fraction of patients where it's going to be a major problem, a minor problem, and no problem?
So what I tell patients is that about 20% of patients will have a major problem. That is a toxicity for which I will need to do something about it. That's generally colitis, and that's generally treated with steroids. I also tell them that a lot of patients have very minor toxicities or even no toxicities, but I do prepare them for the possibility that there can be a significant toxicity. And the other thing that I think it's important to tell patients is that the treatment regimen is given every 3 weeks for a maximum of 4 treatments, which is what the FDA-approved treatment scheme is. But the truth is that at the current approved dose of 3 mg/kg, about 30% of patients don't get the full 4 doses because of toxicity. And I try and tell patients that up front so that they don't feel that they were cheated in terms of treatment. And I try to make the point that we don't know how many doses people really need, that the 4 doses were kind of an arbitrary decision. Some patients' immune systems get activated after 1 dose or 2 doses, and giving them additional ipilimumab only makes the side effects worse. We have no evidence that it makes efficacy better. And there are some patients who will go through 4 doses of ipilimumab with nothing in terms of side effects, and one suspects that maybe they need more than 4 doses, but we're not allowed to do that right now. Having said that, though, we've all had patients who've had 4 doses of ipilimumab with virtually no toxicity who have gone on to have very nice responses. So you don't have to have toxicity to have a good response.
Is there a correlation, though, between toxicity and response?
There is. And in fact, if you look at the most mature data, which was just recently published by the National Cancer Institute, they've shown that patients who had grade 3 toxicity were 3 times more likely to respond to ipilimumab compared to patients who had no toxicity.
You mentioned the hypopituitarism. How do you screen for that?
We screen for that a couple of ways. One, everybody gets a TSH at each visit. We also have a very low threshold for checking cortisol levels. We are also very sensitive to any complaints of fatigue. Oncologists have become inured to this complaint. Patients all complain of being tired. And even patients who don't have cancer complain of being tired.
Even the doctors complain of being tired.
The doctors complain. And we tend to brush that off either because, you know, we're all tired, or maybe we brush it off because, yeah, you have cancer. Of course you're tired. But here in patients with ipilimumab, the doctors have to really pay attention to that. Because if the patient continues to complain of being really tired, especially when it seems to be out of proportion to the amount of tumor they have, that's a patient in whom you really have to think that they're a panhypopit, and you really have to get a cortisol or ACTH right away.